So we will see what's next. Collective karma. Oh, there you go. Excellent. Very good. So, collective karma. Right? So, one of the basic teachings on karma is that karma is your own, right? And there's a passage that is part of the daily reflections in the Theravadan tradition. We would always recite at the monastery in Thailand, karma sakomni karma dayado karma yoni karma bandhu karma patisarano. I am the owner of the karma, the heir of my karma. I'm born of my karma, related to my karma, and I abide supported by my karma. Whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I shall be the heir. And so that's that idea, right? That karma is your own. And I think certainly the kind of core focus, the point of the teaching of karma, right? The main point of it is to talk about your individual choices, right? Do we choose to do good? We choose to do bad? And that's really what the doctrine of karma is trying to point to, right? Now, of course, that then sort of exposes a problem, which is that we're not just individuals, right? We are social creatures. We live in community, and very often we make choices in community, don't we, right? So, and those choices have effects, just as individual choices do. And sometimes that might be formally we do that. We might be part of a group or a board or a committee or something like that, or a sangha, and the sangha makes a decision, right? So I mentioned before that like the formal legal term for making decisions in the sangha is called a sangha kamma, right? So it's like a group kamma, right? So the sangha has made that decision. And similarly, we do the same thing in society all the time, right? We go to the polls and we elect a government who will come along and represent us, so we can be proud to say that these people are representing our ideas. So that's how it works in theory anyway, right? And so the teaching of karma, I think, generally works well on that individual level. But what about on that group level? And the question that Barbara raised is sort of like at the other end of the same problem, right? Can you have shared results, right? Can you have shared actions and shared results? And I think that's an area where the doctrine of karma is not so well. I don't think it's so well equipped to handle, or perhaps so it wasn't intended to handle that those kinds of cases so well. So one of the things which you find talked about quite a lot, perhaps within the Tibetan tradition. I'm not familiar with how it's talked about in the Tibetan tradition, but certainly in kind of popular Buddhism and so on, they'll talk a lot about group karma or collective karma or something like that. And so then a group can perform an act and then receive the responsibility for it. Now, the question here really, I guess, is whether there's an independent thing which is kind of different, right? So whether the actions of a group perform something actually different, or whether it's actually just the actions of all the individuals in that group which happen to be the same choice at that particular time, right? So this is the question of what we're talking about. If you think about it, say, in legal terms, there's also that same kind of nuancing of it, because you establish the legal idea of a corporation as being a person, right? And that's precisely why you do that, so that the corporation can make acts, but all the people in that corporation can escape the responsibility for performing those acts, right? So the corporation can go bankrupt, but the people will be fine, right? And that's exactly the same kind of idea. So in that legal sense, which is a limited legal sense of a person, you actually do have like a collective karma, which is actually separate from, right? At least legally, is separate from the individual karma of the people who make up that entity. So this is really the question: is whether there's a similar thing like that. So I don't really think there is. There's certainly no basis for that in the suttas, that there's this kind of separate group karma. But of course, we do make decisions together, and then if you make the same decision at the same time with that group of people and so on, then of course you're setting up that karmic energy, which is going to lead to similar results. Having said which, it's not always going to lead to similar results, because each the choice which which choices which we make, right, will depend on all the other things that we do, right? So if you have two people on a committee and making a decision, the committee makes the same decision, but one person on the committee is a lying, cheat and fraud, and the other person on the committee is a generous, kind-hearted, good person. The committee makes the same decision, right? But obviously the good person is going to get much more abundant results if it's a good decision as opposed to the nasty person. So that the karma doesn't have any deterministic results, right? So the actual fruits of karma can vary depending on the other conditions which you have. And this is that simile of the this is in the readings for the later workshops, but the simile of the teaspoon of salt. So if you put a teaspoon of salt into a glass of water, the water will be very salty. But you put the same teaspoon into a lake of water and you won't even taste it. Yeah? So it's the idea that if you have lots of good karma, you do lots of good things, then, well, you can mess around a little bit and make a few bad things and so on, never mind, you won't even... Buddha was trying to say, it's okay, never mind. No, that wasn't the point, right? So the point is that the way that karma fruits, right, like a bad act will always have a bad fruit, but how that fruits will be different. Also, you can think about it in terms of like growing seeds, you know? So karma is like a seed. And if you have a mango seed, then you'll always give rise to a mango plant, right? A mango tree, but are the fruits sour or sweet? Is it a big tree or a small tree? Is there lots of fruit or little fruit? They will depend on all of the other conditions, the soil and the weather and the insects and all of those things. But you're not going to get an orange tree, right? You're not going to get a pear tree. It'll always be a mango. Yeah, so something like that with karma. So this is a problem also of vicarious atonement, which is not a term you hear in discussing Buddhism very much, but it's very prominent in and quite problematic in Christian theology and also in a lot of other theologies and so on. So basically, if you know, the usual interpretation of Christianity is that Adam and Eve did this bad thing. Well, Eve did this bad thing. And Adam went along with it because he was too stupid, right? And but it was also a fantastic presentation of that once by this Christian scholar. She's saying, you know, if you look at the story in the Bible, right, when Eve went to the apple, she plucked the apple, she smelt it, she looked at it, she reflected on it, and she investigated, and after doing all of that, only she decided to eat. And then she offers it to Adam, and he just grabbed it and bit it straight away. So vicarious atonement, right? There's one person does something, somebody else gets a result, right? This is the idea. So Adam and Eve do bad things, so all through your children's children and unto the X generation, then you're going to get these bad things. And then Jesus comes along and he's going to save us, and he's going to undo that and so all the generations and so on. So it's the idea that somebody can do something and somebody else gets the result from it, right? So this, again, is completely against the teaching of karma, right? So the teaching of karma, you only get the results that you've made for yourself. So this is, I think, one of the big problems that we tend to get into when you start to look at this thing of collective karma, right? Now if you think of it in a limited point of view, right? So you think maybe, say the staff here at the Buddhist Library have a meeting, they decide to put on a course for next year. They're going to put on the Karma and Rebirth and Early Buddhism course. So they, as a group, make that decision to do that, and then they can put on the course, and then they will, you know, receive karmic fruits of that for good or for ill, right? Maybe it's good because lots of people are hearing Dhamma and so on. Maybe it's bad because we're destroying Theravada Buddhism or something by doing this. I don't know. But whether it's good or bad, I think it's probably, on the whole, better than worse. But anyway, you can see in that kind of limited sense that it makes sense, right? But on the other hand, when you start to look at it on a bigger scale, it starts to become much more problematic, right? And so I've heard people, for example, say things like, say somebody was asked why Cambodia has been so distraught and such a damaged country for so long, and people say, oh, because they used to do so much black magic. Right, Cambodian Buddhism was really decadent, and they were full of witchcraft and all of these kinds of things, which is true. It was. I don't know if it was more so than other forms of Buddhism, but certainly was a lot of that kind of stuff going on. So therefore, that's why Cambodia is so messed up. Right. So problem with that, of course, is that, well, it wasn't that little baby's fault, right, who just got born. They weren't the one who was doing all of these things. So it's like it becomes very, very vague and a very kind of a catch-all way of describing things, which I think is not very helpful. And I think in looking at different societies and places, it's much better to look in terms of things which you can meaningfully see, like social, historical, cultural, political, and so on events. And usually you can understand these things reasonably well in those terms without having to invoke the law of karma as a catch-all explanation for everything. Questions?
Two quick ones. One thing with vicarious atonement, could be a bit controversial, but it sounds a little bit like what the sort of Sri Lankan cultural practice of pouring water for your departed relatives.
That's the next one of the next myths coming up.
Okay, so I'll leave that one.
Leave that one, yeah. But you're true, yeah, that's a similar kind of idea. Yeah.
I wonder if it would actually do it. It could be quite as strong. Also, just again, this might be something you explore at some other point in the course in some other way, but just this whole idea of, you know, there was a baby in our family recently, and my mom's cousin was like, oh, I wonder who that might be, kind of because of the karma thing. And, you know, I just wondered if you do, you have those case studies where people investigate this and they find out, oh, that is your uncle or something, you know. And it'd just be really interesting to explore, like, people who have that belief system and who there's, like, seems so much evidence to suggest is a particular person who is an ancestor, you know, how that actually plays out in how they relate to that baby and as a person, and especially if you have some kind of connection to that ancestor, you know, good or bad, it'd be interesting, yeah.
Yeah. We'll look at that more. We'll have a whole workshop, actually, to look at those kinds of things, those kinds of cases and so on. So, yeah, we'll have plenty of time to have a look.
Okay,
yeah, another good example, yeah. So again, the question is, we're talking about collective karma, what about climate change? I mean, you know, all of us have made those choices sometimes, haven't we, right? We've chosen to buy stuff, right? We've chosen to drive our car or to fly in a plane or to do all of these things which have contributed to global warming, right? In fact, all of us are contributing to global warming as we're sitting here. We're breathing out, right? Carbon dioxide, yeah? Right, so don't think that you're guilt-free, yeah? So if you really want to stop contributing to global warming, fourth jhana, right? No more breathing in and out, yeah? So that's the only way to not contribute to global warming. So, but that's a very good point. You know, in a sense, you know, you can see that there actually is a moral dimension to those choices, isn't there, right? I mean, we are actually selfish, right? We are actually greedy, and that's why we buy all these things, and that's why we don't care what the results of it are, and that's why we'll choose to buy something that's more convenient, you know, all of these kind of packaging and things like that, like these ridiculous... Who's got these ridiculous coffee things with these packets where you have like one packet for these tiny... Terrible! When I was going around Europe, every kitchen seems to have these things. They're slow, inconvenient, make terrible coffee, incredibly expensive, and everybody has them. And you throw out these whole packets. They gave them to us at the monastery, right? We got one at Jhana Grove and one at the Nolamara City Centre. And I bring it up at the Sangha meeting. I'm saying, please, can we get rid of these things? You know, because as long as you've got them, right, they will suck demand into them, right? Somebody will say, oh, do you have any coffee things? Oh, you've run out of things, so you get more. And then you have to keep buying more and it has to be the same brand. And they're saying, oh, we have to find somebody who wants it. I say, don't find somebody who wants it. Get a sledgehammer. Smash the thing, right? These things should not exist.
They are recyclable.
Are they? Yes. Into what?
Into another life. Unfortunately, the coffee isn't.
Yeah,
and
no.
So out of laziness, people don't recycle because they have to get the coffee out of those little... It's like aluminium.
Yeah.
Aluminium. So
yeah.
It's recyclable, but also hard work. So
yeah. Laziness means. Anyway, so this is just kind of one example. We can all think of lots of other examples, right? And so in a sense, but on the other hand, right? On the other hand, you know, most of us would rather if our governments and corporations and so on would make more sensible decisions, right? Actually, we'd prefer it if they weren't going to, you know, be dumping, you know, destroying all those wetlands at the Abbott Point development and all of these kinds of things. So are we actually responsible for those choices, right, which somebody else has made, right? Even though maybe we've tried to stop them, you know? And so these kinds of things, I think, are an interesting area, and it's not an area, again, it's not an area where I think karma is, I don't think it's specialised, I don't think it's tuned for answering those kinds of issues. And I think this is sometimes is where we can get into some deep water. Yeah. But certainly in terms of our own individual responsibility, then we should, you know, do what we can individually. And part of our individual responsibility is also to affect the people around us and to affect the society and to use our voice, to respect the fact that a lot of people for a long time have sacrificed and given a lot so that we can live in a democratic society with freedom of speech, right? And we can go back to the Magna Carta, if we like, and look at the history of the evolution of democracy and how many people have tried so hard so that we can all have a vote and that we can all say what we like without fear of being put into jail or something like that, yeah? And so we, I think, have that kind of, when we've been given that responsibility, I think we have a duty to use that voice, use that right speech in a positive way to try to create that change. Yeah.
Just on that note, it's interesting, there's so many things that we are responsible for in a roundabout way that we don't have direct control over. So
right.
I was just thinking, for example, we pay taxes and the taxes could go for a variety of things, but we may be good or bad effects and you know,
right.
To what extent, or like if you're buying clothing, you know, sometimes it's manufactured in sweatshops or whatever it is. To what extent are we responsible for that? And even if we have an inkling that it may be possible, you know, you've got like a busy day, you've got to choose between this jumper and that jumper, you pick one, you can't investigate its whole process. But you are, in a way, contributing to that problem. So how much do you really get
yeah.
be responsible for it?
Yeah, just to repeat the question, but so there's... We're very frequently making choices where we're in that kind of grey area of being making choices but not being 100% in control of the choices that we're making. One example was given was paying taxes, and the government might do things both good and bad with those tax money. In that case, I don't think we so much have a choice, really. I mean, unless you're making extra donations to the government just out of the kindness of your heart. Most of us fairly just pay what we have to. So I think it's a bit of a different situation there. But then, again, buying things, right? So we constantly have to buy vegetables. Are they organic or non-organic? Are they killing animals to get the vegetables or not? Are we, you know, say, buying shirts? Are they, you know, do they come from a sweatshop or something like this? And these things are complex and they're difficult. Even, you know, companies like Apple and so on say, we don't know, you know, we can't know where all of the parts come from, right? And, you know, things like, say, shrimp paste, right? I mean, there was this terrible expose about the Thai shrimp industry last year, basically, quite apart from the fact of killing shrimp and all of the environmental issues, but the whole thing's run on slavery. So every time that you're buying Thai shrimp paste and fish paste and all of these kinds of things, you are supporting slavery. Right? Like real bad slavery, not just bonded workers where they take away your passport and stuff like that, but like locking people up in cages and torturing them kind of slavery, like the real bad stuff. So this is going on today. So yeah, enjoy your Thai meal at the Thai restaurant this evening. So... how responsible are we for these things, right? Now, one of the things I think to understand is that I think the system, if you will, it's a terrible word, but if you like, the system is designed in order to make you feel not responsible, okay? And to remove you from that sense of recognition of the consequences of your acts, right? and this is why, you know, advertising and packaging and all of this kind of stuff is there to distance yourself from that. You know, that would be a good thing, wouldn't it, to have we have like the cigarette packaging where you actually see what the results of it are. It'd be good if you could apply that generally to every consumer good. Actually, that'd be a great idea, wouldn't it, right? Every consumer good you see, these are the mines where the material was come out. This is the workers' homes of the people who built it, right? This is the pollution that was generated from it, you know, and so on. And to get some idea of what the implications of it are. So I think what we need to do is to, if we recognize that the overwhelming tendency or trend is to remove our awareness from the consequences of those acts, right? We have a responsibility to undo that, to become more aware and become more conscious of what the consequences of those choices are. Yeah? Of course, we can never do it 100%, but we can do it with some things. We do it the best that we can. And to try to become aware that, you know, these things come from that place, they're made from these materials, these are the conditions, and so on and so forth. And the more that we can become aware of those things, we can actually make genuinely meaningful changes. I mean, these things, the consumer awareness of these things is a very powerful force and has made a lot of changes already and is continuing, you know, is ongoing. You know, I just saw in the paper just a week or two ago, new laws, I think, in California on battery hens. They're now enlarging the battery hen cages, I think, in California or something. Anyone know any more about that? Maybe not. So, you know, these things can actually make differences. So definitely I think it's good to become as aware of those things as possible. Yeah, Barbara.
Did the Buddha actually study to remove monastics from karmic consequences in that rule that... Well, it's in the Theravada tradition, I don't know about otherwise, that monks can eat meat that has, as long as it's not been slaughtered specifically for them.
Right.
But they're removed from the karmic consequences if they just eat some that's been bought already dead from the supermarket.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so that's a kind of classic conundrum, and I think that's, you know, points to, again, I think a kind of a, maybe a limitation or, you know, I think... Not even a limitation, but this idea that there are some areas that karma, teaching and karma isn't so well equipped to handle. I just want to just backtrack. I'll come to that question in more detail in a minute. But when I was at university, I studied moral philosophy, and we looked at different kinds of moral language. Okay, so we're familiar with some of these different kinds of moral language. One of them might be, say, the language of rights, right? Human rights, animal rights, and so on. That's a way of talking about moral issues. Another kind of moral language might be like a theological language, right? To talk about what God permitted and what he didn't permit and so on. So there are different like frameworks that we can come to talk about moral issues from. And one of the things that you learn if you look at those things and compare them is that each framework has its kind of strengths and weaknesses, right? That there are certain things that will actually be addressed quite well within that framework. And then other things you think, oh, actually... I'm not quite sure how that deals with it. So I think that, you know, the teaching on karma and rebirth, I think many issues it handles very well, but there are some kinds of things, and we come to these edge cases where, not by saying edge cases, I don't mean that they're unimportant, they're clearly important cases, but they're edge cases in the sense that they're not kind of directly addressing at the core concerns of what the teaching of karma and rebirth was originally about. Yeah. So that issue was one which was, you know, raised in the time of the Buddha. There was a difference between the Buddhists and the Jains, and the Jains criticized the Buddhists for that view. That difference still continues today, and in India, the town of Palitana in northwestern India became the first vegetarian city in the world a couple of months ago. On the Jain monks did a hunger strike, okay? Until the government made the whole city vegetarian. I don't know if anybody told them that Jain monks do hunger strikes anyway. That's just their normal practice. I don't know if they were doing anything different. But anyway, the outcome of it was interesting. I mean, it's interesting because that is a classical Jaina practice, is to do these long fasts. And they were using that as a political instrument in order to literally abolish the selling of meat and killing of animals within the city limits. Yeah, so the fishermen were pissed off, Muslims were pissed off, Hindus were probably, oh yes. So I'm not sure, you know, how long that will last or how that will work, but that's the differences there. So the issue in the eating of meat is that if you eat a nice juicy hamburger, you don't have any intention to harm, right? I don't have any intention to harm if I'm eating a piece of bacon. I love pigs. May all the pigs be happy. And I want to enjoy, a piece of bacon. You can ask yourself the question, if this bacon was to be cultivated in a Petri dish, right, which of course they can do now, right? Last year, a couple of years ago, they actually grew meat in the laboratory, right? So if that's, and they made a hamburger out of it, and they said it tasted okay, right? So if that was the case, then, you know, obviously then presumably you'd still be leaving health or other issues aside, right? But from a moral point of view, you'd probably be just as happy to eat that or even happier, right? So there's no actual sense that you're wanting to harm, no intention to harm, yet still the outcome is harm, right? And it's not, you know, just eating meat, but we do these things every day. I mean, you guys, when you finish here, we'll get in your car and drive home, squashing insects along the way, using petrol, all of those things. So we actually cause unintentional harm, you know, all the time. My personal view on the eating meat thing is it's a bit of a cop-out. I think that we should try to be vegetarian as much as possible, or vegan is even better, and we should try to minimize the amount of meat. In terms of global warming, not eating meat is either the biggest or second biggest impact that we can really make on the environment, right? Apart from the fossil fuels thing, but becoming vegetarian makes a huge impact on the environment, positive impact. So I think there are many, many good reasons to be vegetarian. But I'm still kind of reluctant to say that kind of eating meat as such is bad karma. I would like to be able to say that, right? But I don't know if I can.
An abrogation of responsibility, isn't it?
Perhaps.
And then it would mean that any act committed in ignorance, willful or otherwise, didn't have any karma attached to it, if you didn't intend any harm. But surely the law of karma in Buddhism, of course, intention is everything, and that's why eating meat that wasn't killed, especially for you, is fine. But doesn't this cause a lot of problems? Doesn't it mean that there's so many actions occurring constantly in the world that only ones that have intention behind them come to karmic fruition? Wouldn't that mean that karma, in the overall scheme of things, could actually play a very tiny, minor role in our lives rather than being such a big deal?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily tiny, but you know, it is. It's not necessarily complete. It doesn't describe everything.
So
we have that enshrined in our statutes.
Yeah.
The fact that just because we didn't know it was we were driving at 50 or 30 zone, ticket and demerit points. We should have known. And I think karma works a little bit like that. Particularly since we have access, or particularly when we do have access to the teachings. But the fact that some of our actions, we think, well, we didn't consciously have the intention. And that, the fact that there is an intention that we may not have been aware of, is our own stupid fault. And that's what we could spend our lives usefully investigating.
I would also imagine that if you performed a lot of acts and are ignorant of the potential for bad karmic direction, it's probably likely that you're picking up bad karma in a whole bunch of other areas. Well, I would imagine, just imagine the structure of your whole life and your behaviours, you wouldn't be wholesome in other domains as well. So maybe it's not directly linked to that ignorant behaviour, but it might be in other areas of that person's life. But if it's all about intention, Yeah.
We're on a really slippery slope here, because if we say, well, I didn't intend the animal harm, but I just wanted a juicy steak, we could also say, you know, the abattoirs are there, so whatever. The brothel is there, so I just wanted physical pleasure. I didn't intend the prostitute harm, but still harm happens. Human trafficking happens. I mean, you could use the same logic.
Right. There is intention, though. I mean, I think I like what Nicholas said, that you may not be aware that you have negative intentions, but a lot of negative acts do have you coming from a certain space which is negative, but you're not like, it's not, your mind is maybe not subtle enough to even be aware of your intention.
In that case, is it intended?
Sorry?
Unless you form an intention.
Well, it's still intended, because you do, you know, you're coming from a negative thing, maybe from anger or whatever. I think in with regard to like a stake or something, it's subtle, because most people know when they're kind of opening the packaging and they see that it's flesh, you know, they probably know that it's come from an animal and maybe reflect a little bit on it, but it's, yeah, I don't know, it's kind of great, isn't it?
Yeah, these are complex issues, yeah? I mean, sometimes going to a brothel might be good karma. Well, when I was in Singapore a couple of years ago, this lady came up and was talking. She was a sex worker, and she was saying that a couple of days before, this guy had come to see her, and it turned out they were both fans of Ajahn Brahm. So they ended up spending the whole time talking about Ajahn Brahm's book.
But I think the central issue here is that we don't want to have an interpretation of the law of karma which encourages willful blindness.
Right, yes.
Interpretation of the law of karma which encourages delusion and
right,
lack of
yeah.
responsibility. Mm. So my personal approach is that if I do eat a piece of meat, then yes, it is bad karma for me, whether or not it's come from the market or somebody has killed it deliberately for me. But the karma is much, much worse if someone's killed it deliberately for me. But I don't think you get enlightened by having perfect karma. You get enlightened by having good enough karma and using that good enough karma to spur your practice towards enlightenment.
Mm. Yeah, it's very hard, because you can't be completely pure, right? I mean, you know, the animals are killed to produce rice, and
the roads that I work on were bulldozed through, killed the ants and all the worms.
Sugar is apparently filtered through charred animal bones, the refining process for sugar.
Oh, that's terrible food.
You see? You're blissfully ignorant beforehand.
Still vegetarian. In this day and age, you can make enlightened choices. And certain causes and choices we make have certain effects.
Sure.
So
you can certainly improve things. So the question shouldn't be, can you do it 100% pure? Mm-hmm. And I think this is like the message of, this like story of the Bodhisattva who's sitting there watching the ploughing of the fields and seeing the worms turned up and being eaten. Basically, as long as you're in samsara, you're going to be involved in that stuff somehow. But you can make the best choices you can to reduce the harm that you're doing, right? So this is what you can do. And I think being vegetarian is one of the choices we can make, which is going to be the greatest reduction in harm, right, for the least cost and disadvantage for ourselves. Yeah.
All conditioned things have a cause, and the cause that Tathagata taught.
Yeah. Sure.
So I think it's really important to take responsibility for the indirect consequences of our actions, because the Buddha taught us to think long term. If we don't take responsibility for those indirect consequences, then we fail to be wise people who see beyond just short-term consequences. But then it works both ways. You can do good things that have indirect good consequences and bad things that have indirect bad consequences.
Can you do good things that have indirect bad consequences?
Yes. Yeah, you can.
Yes.
If you don't investigate, if you encourage willful blindness in your mind, if you encourage dull stupidity inside your mind.
No, it's not necessarily that. You think, what about the Second World War, where they decide to go to war to defend democracy?
Uh-huh.
Well, their intention is good.
Mm-hmm.
Then the soldiers' intention is probably similar, but then they will commit the bad kind of killing.
Mm-hmm.
practicing.
Yeah, so I mean, that's one of the things, which will come up later, but in the Buddha talked about karma, which is black and white, which leads to black and white results. So it's not the case that everything we can do is either right or wrong. Sometimes it's both.
But so many bad things happen because we either don't care and don't think about the result. We don't want to see the result. In many cases we can. We know we're destroying the planet. We know there's human trafficking because of prostitution.
But we can't forecast. That's a thing.
But a lot of these are things. The planet has got so much suffering because people do not choose to see the results of their actions. If we saw that, we wouldn't do it and it wouldn't happen.
We can't know everything, but we can know enough to make better choices. Yeah?
We know that half the world is living on $1.25 a day. We choose to do nothing about it. We choose to continue living a lifestyle which is destroying the planet, which is unsustainable, which leads to the poverty of people in developing countries. I mean, of course it's not as simple as, you know, Band-Aid or what Bono said in the 1980s, but we could do a hell of a lot more if we were aware. Because we're unaware, so many bad things happen. Because we choose to not be aware.
And with that awareness, we can make a lot more good choices with indirect good consequences, which, at least in my opinion, gives us the good karma that we need to attain the final goal in early Buddhism, which is nirvana. So it works both ways, and we can use it skillfully. We need not think that the idea of indirect karmic consequences necessarily makes practice impossible. If you see from a different perspective, it empowers us to practice. See, we shouldn't give up on doing good things with indirect good consequences simply because it's impossible to be perfect. Yeah, we can see it another way and say we can't be perfect, but we can be good enough. And let's use our intelligence to think long term, take responsibility for the indirect consequence of our actions so that we can make the world a better place and get enlightened at the same time.
Okay, very good. So there we have a good. Maybe can we finish off there? Sorry, Kate. Can you hold that to the next time? We're over time already. Let's have a break. Come back at 20 to 4 with the last session, and we'll continue with various other myths. But I think, as far as collective karma goes, we are busted.